This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Many people in eastern North Carolina enjoy spending a hot summer day fishing at the beach or along one of the region's waterways. Since 2007, anglers have been required to pay $5 to $30 for a recreational fishing license. Although most fishermen are reluctant to pay, the money generated through the sale of these licenses supports local fisheries and projects that provide water access and education. The fishing license requirement was established as a result of 2005 legislation that aimed at enhancing marine resources in the state. The Coastal Recreational Fishing License Program Coordinator is Beth Cavani.
An average of about $5.5 million is generated through the sale of the coastal fishing licenses.
Each year, a portion of the license fee goes to fund projects to manage, restore, protect, develop, and enhance marine resources. This fiscal year, about 44% of the overall sale of the fishing license was used to fund the grants. According to the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries website, nearly $10 million in grant money has been awarded in the last 5 years. Dr. Joel Faudry, the assistant professor of fisheries at the Institute of Marine Sciences, has received about $400,000 for 2 grants focusing on habitat studies.
Our lab tries to connect fish populations to habitat. I think we all have a general appreciation that habitat is valuable. But beyond that, we really struggle to quantitatively say this much habitat equals this much fish production.
Faudry says the goal of the study is to determine what types of habitat are conducive to supporting healthy fisheries. The way they collect their data is by tagging different species of fish.
These are tags that we surgically implant inside fish, and we've worked with red drum, black drum, sheephead. And once the tag is inside the fish, it sends out a ping, ping, ping. And we have these listening stations that we place around the sounds and around habitat. And if a fish comes close to that listening station, it's registered that the fish was in the area. And not only that a fish was in the area, but that fish.
The information is gathered and posted on their website, where anglers can see the movements and behaviors of a particular fish species.
These tracks that we map and play videos of essentially sort of make the fish not invisible, so that you can see where they're at in the time of any given time of the day or where you can see where they're at seasonally within an estuary, like the New River.
You can find a link to those maps at our website, publicradioeast.org. Faudry's project is being funded through the end of 2015. Another study, conducted by North Carolina State University grad student Tim Ellis, focused on tagging spotted sea trout. The project started in 2009 when spotted sea trout was overfished.
Most of our fish that we tagged were caught hook and line, utilizing the help of recreational fishing guides across the state, and we would mark these fish with an external tag, and it would have a phone number and a tag number on it, and then we'd release those fish and essentially rely on the fishery or fishermen to call in any tag fish that they catch and give us that tag number and some other information about the fish, like where they caught it and the length of it and things like that.
Ellis says they were primarily interested in the movement and the mortality of spotted sea trout, two important aspects of the local fishery that are poorly known.
With mortality in particular, we're interested in separating that out into its fishing and natural components. So fishing mortality is essentially what it sounds like, harvest and catch and release mortality, anything associated with fishing practices. And then natural mortality is everything else, so predation or disease or old age or bad water quality, all the natural causes of death. And so we used our tagging data to model and create estimates of that fishing and natural mortality.
The information on spotted sea trout movement and mortality will be used in future stock assessments, as well as to compare natural and fishing mortalities in hopes of preventing overfishing. Other projects funded by the recreational fishing license fees focus on monitoring water quality. In 1999, a program called Ferrymon was initiated. Dr. Hans Perl, Keenan professor at the Institute of Marine Sciences, says ferries that cross the Pamlico Sound are fitted with instruments that measure basic water quality parameters.
Water taken in by the ferries to cool their air conditioning system, diverted through a black box below deck, has a set of sensors in it that are constantly monitoring things like temperature, pH, salinity of the water, algae content. The data from those sensors automatically gets sent back to our laboratories by the internet.
The data is charted so officials with the Division of Water Quality and Division of Marine Fisheries can monitor real-time the water quality in the Pamlico Sound. If an issue is detected, a lab technician has the ability to remotely take a water sample that can be thoroughly analyzed later. The North Carolina Department of Transportation-based Ferrymon program did not receive any funding from the state this fiscal year. Rather, $143,000 from the recreational fishing license will keep the Ferrymon program going for another 2 years.
First of all, the Pamlico Sound is the second largest estuary in the country. It's the most important fisheries nursery along the East Coast. And equally important, Ferrymon is the only monitoring program that we have for water quality on that system. So it's really important to keep it alive and keep it working for the state.
A total of 20 grant proposals were awarded funds from the recreational fishing license this fiscal year. $650,000 was allocated for the construction of a boating and fishing access in Onslow County, and a multi-year grant was issued to purchase property to build a boating access area in Vandermeer. To see a complete list of projects, visit our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The cost of caring for Alzheimer's patients is expected to skyrocket as earlier detection is being touted by health professionals. It's a double-edged sword, as L.C. Morris explains.
Recognizing the signs of Alzheimer's disease is just as hard on loved ones as it is to the person experiencing the distortion of life as they know it. Dr. Lynn Leachy is a professor and director of clinical services at Memory Assessment and Research Services at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington.
By the time they bring them in, the person's well into a dementia. 7-8 years, the people have been whispering something may be wrong. And then when the person, you know, is getting lost in a neighborhood that they've lived in for 50 or 60 years, and they say, oh, well, let's bring them in. Well, at that point, they're profoundly demented.
The most common early symptom of Alzheimer's is difficulty remembering newly learned information, because Alzheimer's changes typically begin in the part of the brain that affects learning. There are 7 stages of Alzheimer's. Tom McCann's 75-year-old wife, Kathleen, is in the moderate stage.
I never leave for more than an hour. If nobody else is going to be here, I'm not going more than an hour, because that's about the break point. She'll be walking up and down when I get back and say, where were you? Where were you? Even though I've told her before, said, okay, now where am I going? She'll repeat it back to me. But then when I get back in an hour, she will say, where were you? I was worried about you.
Kathleen, who still resides in her family home in the northern hills of Raleigh with her husband of 52 years, was diagnosed in 2007.
The early phases, she was more aware that she was forgetting more and things of this nature. Along the way, we were offered to go into trials on different drugs, and we labored over this. Finally, I came to her and I said, what do you want to do? And she says, I don't want anything else. I know who I am, and that's where I am.
Alzheimer's is not a normal part of aging, although the greatest known risk factor is increasing age, and the majority of people with Alzheimer's are 65 and older. But Alzheimer's is not just a disease of old age. Up to 5% of people with the disease have early onset, which often appears when someone is in their 40s or 50s. Leachy, who also serves on the board of directors of Alzheimer's North Carolina, says that establishing a baseline of cognitive functions around 50 years of age is the best way to assess later on.
For most individuals, when you start getting approximately the age of 55, that's a good time to start thinking about a baseline assessment. Certainly that would be a good time to, one, potentially detect any early onset to a time when you are more likely to have some difficulties.
In North Carolina, there are more than 415,000 caregivers, and Tom is no different.
I have asked the doctor this. I've asked, what is the long term? Okay, so we're in year 7. She said probably because of her good health, the way things are, she will be maybe up to 14 years total. which is a long time in Alzheimer's Association type thing, from start to finish. Last 2 years of that, you know, there would be no cognizance whatsoever. I don't know how that'll evidently play out, and I'm not sure how it'll play out.
Nearly 15% of caregivers for people with Alzheimer's or another dementia are long-distance caregivers. Those in the early stages of dementia may be undiagnosed and susceptible to self-neglect. Jacqueline Marcel's father and mother both were diagnosed with Alzheimer's. The diagnosis came only after Jacqueline, like many others, passed it off as what would come with aging.
My father had always had a bad temper. It was never at me, but all of a sudden it was, screaming and yelling and throwing me out of the house. And I had gone up to San Francisco to help my parents, and thought I'd be there for a month, and I was there for a year without a day off with a father who kept throwing the caregivers out of the house. What was happening was he was in the beginnings of Alzheimer's disease.
Marcel, the author of Take My Father, Please, How to Survive Caring for Aging Parents, is also a caregiver advocate and an Alzheimer's speaker.
And I'd take him to the doctor, and he'd be adorable and normal, and they'd say, what day is it, what time is it, who's the governor, and they'd, he seems fine to us, and they'd send me home. And then he'd be fine for a few days or a week, and then there'd be some other weird episode where he would scream and yell and pound his fist and illogical and irrational. And I'd say, but Dad, I threw away this handheld because it was so dilapidated. I didn't even think it would make it through the washing machine. I bought you a new one. It was $1.50. I was just shocked.
Most people don't recognize when forgetting becomes a serious problem. Knowing the warning signs can help. They range from changes in mood and personality to new problems with words or speaking and writing. According to Leachy, performing cognitive tests can lower the threshold of full-blown dementia.
Think about the treatment of cancer. If we only detected people who were in stage 4 cancer, we would have incredibly low survival rates. One of the main reasons it's progressed is because of early detection. We have not made that same move in the treatment of Alzheimer's. So for Alzheimer's dementia, we are still largely catching people when they're in the moderate to profound stages, so the equivalent of the last stages of cancer.
The Alzheimer's Association predicts Alzheimer's will cost the nation $203 billion. This number is expected to rise to $1.2 trillion by 2050. Alice Watkins, who is the executive director for the North Carolina chapter, says that not everyone sees Alzheimer's as a threat.
Nationally and internationally, there is not enough money being designated for Alzheimer's research. We need to get on the same bandwagon as cancer and heart and AIDS and all of the others, because this disease is lasting for so long and is bankrupting the country. And as far as funding is concerned, when people don't have the funds to do it, they have to go on Medicaid. And everyone knows Medicaid is just bursting at the seams. And frankly, I don't know what we're going to do if we don't find some answers pretty soon.
In North Carolina, there's been a spike in Alzheimer's diagnosis at earlier ages. And Watkins says funding is being stretched to cover many costs associated with that.
When we start losing them at age 39 and early 40s, I mean, this is a whole different generation that we're having to deal with and provide services for, because they have small children or college-age children. So it takes on a whole new set of caregiving dynamics.
Over 170,000 people in North Carolina have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease as of 2010. That is a 31% increase from 130,000 in 2000. For a list of warning signs and more information, please visit alz.org, and Jacqueline Marcel's book can be found at elderrage.com. I'm L.C. Morris.
My first car. It was a 62 Chevy Bel Air. Oh, it was magnificent.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers.
No, it was a piece of junk. In fact, this car had the dubious distinction of using more oil than it did gasoline. I'd pull into the gas station, I'd say, fill the oil and check the gas. Now, wouldn't it be great if even a car like that could be turned into the programs that you love?
For more information, call 866-789-8627. Next Saturday, July 27th, a dragon boat race will take place in downtown New Bern, where the Neuse and Trent Rivers meet. Zanny Owens has more.
Last summer, hundreds gathered at Union Point Park to witness New Bern's first ever dragon boat race, organized by the Coastal Carolina River Watch Association. The chairman of the program, Rick Dove, is enthusiastic about bringing the event to our local waters.
Dragon boat racing is developing into a major water sport event in the United States. It's happening all over the country, all the way from California to the East Coast. And it really is big on the East Coast. Some of these regional races are huge, and some people take them very, very seriously. You know, our race is more about just having fun.
Dragon boats resemble a long canoe. They're quite large and ornate and require an entire team of people to guide it to the finish line.
These boats are 45 feet long. They got a huge dragon head on the front, tail on the back, and a drummer in the front who beats out the cadence, and 21 paddlers in the drummer, making a crew of 22, with a helmsman who steers, guide these boats to the finish line. It's wet, it's wild, and it really is a lot of fun.
The race is only a couple minutes long. Dove says the key to winning the race is cooperation. Teammates must paddle in quick, synchronized motions.
The trick to making these boats move fast isn't just to paddle hard, but it's to paddle in sync with everybody else. So that drummer's job is to keep everybody paddling in the same motion. It's not just brute strength. It has a lot to do with timing.
The first ever Coastal Carolina River Watch Dragon Boat Race was held in 2012 with over 220 participants. While Dove was enthusiastic about last year's turnout, he expects that number to increase dramatically.
Last year, I think in New Bern, there were 10 boats in the race, about 10. This year, we expect to more than double that. So we're really looking forward to really a challenging race.
The event is a fundraiser for the Coastal Carolina River Watch Association. All of the proceeds go towards preserving and restoring rivers in eastern North Carolina.
We make a strong commitment to all our supporters to take all the money that we receive and spend it very, very wisely for river protection. So any support we get, we're not only grateful for it, but we'll use it wisely.
The nonprofit Coastal Carolina River Watch organization started in 1995 and mainly focused on eradicating pollution from animal factories. This January, they reorganized with the intent of monitoring, protecting, and restoring local rivers.
One of our principal goals is to find out what's going on in our waters, our rivers of eastern North Carolina, because unless we can understand what the problems are, you can't really advocate and educate because you got to know. So our first goal is to make sure we understand factually and scientifically what the problems are in each of our rivers in eastern North Carolina. And then once we know that, our next goal is to educate the public, because an informed public can make things happen.
One way to help is by participating in the race. Anyone above the age of 15 is qualified. The program allows for businesses and nonprofit organizations to sponsor teams. If you don't have a team, worry not.
For people that can't put a team together but just want to paddle, really all they have to do is contact the Coastal Carolina River Watch office and give us their name and send us the entry fee, which is $40 per person, and then we'll team them up with others who are in the same position.
So whether it's an individual, a business, or a nonprofit organization, there's still time to form teams and even to enter as an individual. A sponsorship program is also available for those who don't want to paddle but want to support the organization.
Well, this year, we went to Cherry Point and we asked the Marines at Cherry Point, the single Marines, if they'd like to participate. Some of them did last year and they liked it so much that this year we have 120 single Marines who have come to the event and their entry fee is being sponsored by others.
Dove says everyone is welcome to watch the boats glide by at Union Point Park next Saturday, July 27th.
Once you've been to one of these races, you want to be in a boat. And once you're in a boat, you want to do it again and again. It's that much fun.
If you'd like more information on the 2013 Coastal Carolina River Watch Dragon Boat Race, you can go to www.ccriverwatch.org or www.ccriverwatch.org. publicradioeast.org. I'm Zanny Owens.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with the Crystal Coast Civic Center of Moorhead City, where every event is waterfront, business meetings and special event facilities available. Crystal Coast Civic Center, on the web at crystalcoastcivicctr.com.
Hi, this is Tom the Jazz Man inviting you to join me this Sunday evening right here on PRE, Public Radio East, on all five frequencies as we explore the great sounds of America's music, jazz. It was made in America and now it's enjoyed around the world, and musicians all over the world are embracing this wonderful art form. Join us on Sunday evening right here on Public Radio East.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. I've already removed a few ticks from my dogs this year, and that's despite the fact that they each receive monthly flea and tick medication. The ticks had established themselves, and in one case, had even been doing some significant feeding without being killed. So keep in mind that ticks may still be a problem, particularly if you've changed medications and haven't tried out the new one yet. It might be great for fleas and not so good on ticks. I've also found one tick happily scampering across my hand. Luckily, he'd not yet embedded his head and started to feed. But each year, I have at least one. That's because I have long grass growing along the path to my dock. We keep a wide path mowed, but all you have to do is brush up against some tall grass to have a tick that's hovering on the tip of that grass just waiting for you to go by, grab hold, and hike with you for the rest of the day. So what are the concerns with ticks, and what should you be doing? Well, as I mentioned, keeping the grass mowed is a great way to keep tick infestations down. They tend to be in less disturbed areas. If you're going to treat your lawn to try and manage and control ticks, remember, though, that they are also down on the soil surface. So any treatment that you use needs to reach the soil. For this reason, the recommendations are for granular insecticides that are applied to the soil, or hose-based sprayers that spray down to the soil. If you're using a granular insecticide, make sure that the area is moist but not too wet. You don't want the insecticide to stick to the tips of wet grass blades, where it will do no good. It has to reach the soil surface. And for any insecticide, be sure you really follow the label directions carefully. You want to fully cover your yard at the rate recommended. You don't want to do less, and you don't want to do more. So read it carefully, calibrate your application device, and then apply insecticides. What else can you do? Well, as they point out from the university, although it may make you look like a dork, tucking your pants legs into your socks is a wonderful way to help prevent ticks from establishing themselves on you. Also, wear light-colored pants. That way, if a tick does grab hold and start crawling up, you can see him readily and remove him before he reaches any exposed skin. Applying repellents to your socks and pants leg also can help repel ticks. And if you're wearing shorts, making sure you apply repellents to the exposed parts of the skin on your legs can make a big difference. If you do find that a tick has established itself, and it's important to check you and your children each day after being outdoors, remove it carefully with a pair of tweezers. If possible, you can drop it into a small amount of rubbing alcohol and keep it, just in case you need to identify the type later. Circle the date on your calendar. You can't go immediately to a doctor and test to see if the tick had been infected with Rocky Mountain spotted fever or Lyme's disease. Those things don't start building antibodies for a couple weeks, maybe more. So what you can do is check that date off on the calendar and watch for one of the rashes that tends to come from a tick bite. Remember, however, that not everyone who contracts one of the diseases spread by ticks has one of the rashes. So watch for flu-like symptoms that start occurring a few weeks after the tick bite. And if that happens, you may want to talk to your doctor about the possibility of there being a tick-borne illness problem. Don't stay indoors for fear of ticks, but do take reasonable precautions. I would never miss a day walking down to my dock or keep my dogs from running down through the marsh that they enjoy so much just from fear of ticks. But I will check myself and them daily and make sure that I keep them up to date on their medications. You do the same, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.